Hello, my name is Paul Montgomery. I'm the CEO of Teen Finger and Fan Footy, a couple of Australian websites. And I thought I'd do a podcast because I've heard people talking about them and I've heard people doing them. And I have my own blog now that I'm part of the blogosphere, although I suppose a lot of other people are. And it struck me as I was watching an Australian film the other day, called The Magician. If you get a chance to go and see, you should, because it's a very fine movie. But it struck me as I was sitting there watching the film about hitmen and the people who like to film them, that we don't get to see a lot of Australian people up on screen these days in the films who are actually using Australian accents and in Australia, unlike The Magician, which is full of that sort of thing, and very enjoyable it was too. So I thought that it's all very well to have Australian voices in print, but, you know, that's the part of the attraction of a podcast, is you can actually hear the person who's giving you these ideas instead of just reading their wonderful prose. Now, the problem with that, as far as I'm concerned, is that I'm a print journalist by training, and I have a beautiful face for TV. How does the old saying go? I have a face for radio and a voice for print. That's how it goes. So I do stutter, and I do have, you know, a little bit of a lisp now and then when I'm not understanding where I'm coming from, and I don't have all my thoughts all in one easily spoutable row of concepts, as you can hear by what I'm trying to do now. So these podcasts might not be the most slick that you'll ever hear. They're not going to be like, you know, Cameron Riley, who projects himself, his own personality, very strong personality as it is, into the microphone at a great rate of knots without seeming to take any breath. I don't know whether he edits them out afterwards, but yes, I would be intimidated by his inconsiderable quote-unquote radio skills. Despite that, I'll have a go at this podcasting, because you've got to eat your own dog food, as the Americans say. I even went out and tried to buy a microphone, but of course, being stupid, I bought one with the wrong attachment at the end, so I'm having to rely on my old Bud microphone that I used to attach to telephone receivers to tape phone calls with interviewees back in my journalism days. So anyway, we'll see how this goes. Now, for the subject of this first podcast, I've been reading O'Reilly Radar, one of the major blogs in the blogosphere, and they've had this series called Burn In, which is they ask what they call alpha geeks to explain how they got into computers and their first dealings with computers and how they all got passionate enough about it to make it their career. So I thought that'd be a good subject, just to get, talking about me is something that I know the most about out of anyone in the world, with the possible exception of my mother. So anyway, I'll have a stab at that. So my first computer, like a lot of people my age, I'm 32, my first computer was a Commodore. But it wasn't a 64. Most kids got a Commodore 64, but I got mine probably about 6 months to a year after the real curve of that hit Australia, and it was late enough in the development of the Commodore that the 128s were available. So my mum and dad, in their infinite wisdom, paid about three times as much as a Commodore 64 price, and got me the 128D. Which, you know, you would think it'd be twice as good, but it was basically just the C64, and then there was the 128 platform or kernel or whatever the word was, which had different colours. Instead of blue, it was yellow and brown. And but the most important part of it was that it implemented a later version of BASIC. I think it was BASIC 7.0 from very sketchy memory. So I was able to play all the Commodore 64 games. You know, I joined a what could loosely be called a cracking crew. I think they were called the Thundercrackers. And there was a guy up in, a German guy up in Darwin who sent us all these cracked games called Mick, M-I-K, and I went around to, very often, to a friend of mine's place near where I was living in Seymour during my late high school years, and we traded, well, not traded games, I got games from him, and we hung out and tested out his theories on building modems out of spare parts, and yeah, it was all very amateurish by today's standards, but I guess everything was back then. But the Commodore, you know, gave me a love of computers that has lasted to this day, because I suppose the beauty of the Commodore was that it had enough of a friendly user interface that you know, we're not quite as good as Apple's, obviously. Oops, sorry, that was a phone. Anyway, yes, so the Commodore 64 interface was not quite as good as Apple's these days, but it was friendly enough that you could get into it without being too overwhelmed by green screens and not having any graphics at all. So you could dabble with you know, some sort of graphical interface, and you could the instructions were relatively easy, and you could buy magazines on the rack that could, you know, make you do some, or that allow you to do some pretty, you know, what would be considered cool by things for a 15-year-old or 16-year-old. So anyway, I got into eventually, after many years of just playing, I eventually got into coding myself, because there was this one particular game which was called Hounded, which was created by this Australian guy. And it was a greyhound racing simulation, and this cracking crew had cracked it, cracked the security around it. But the game, as it loaded up, there were actually two games. It was Hounded 1 and Hounded 2 in the same pack. But the problem was that Hounded 1 worked, but Hounded 2 didn't work. So what I did was, when I was loading up, and it used to hang every time you loaded it up. So when it hung one time, I thought I'd just hit run stop, as you do, and then try and list the contents of the game. And lo and behold, it was actually written in BASIC. So, you know, not just machine code. So I was able to look at the code of the program and see what was going wrong. And I tested this and tried that and attempted this, and eventually, after mostly cutting out bits that were obviously extraneous, I managed to actually get the thing working, and enjoyed it immensely. And not only got it working, but I, in looking at the code, there was a lot of commented code down the bottom explaining how the programmer had made the program, and, you know, in testing this greyhound racing simulation, he'd developed a stable of, or a kennel of you know, world-beating greyhounds who no one could ever beat, and, you know, you could load them into your game if you felt the need to, you know, bash your greyhounds' heads against the wall of these one, you know, super dogs. So anyway, I loaded these greyhounds into my saved game, and eventually, through many months of developing dogs of varying dispositions, I was actually able to get some that could beat these, you know, these legendary world-beating hounds that only the programmer could create. So that was my first taste of what could be done through hacking, and you know, although I didn't use I didn't even know what that word existed at the time, in that context anyway. So that was probably my signature, you know, introduction to the world of computers, and I went on after that to at university. I wrote for the university student newspaper Catalyst at RMIT, the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, and wrote the paper's first internet column. Went through the whole year writing three separate columns. I think they were separated on the basis of the knowledge of the user. So I think there was a newbie, and then there was a net.user, and then there was a .wizard, I think it was. And then halfway through the year, we were assuming that there were no newbies anymore if they'd been reading my columns, so we dropped the newbie bit and just went to the net users and .wizards. So that was what got me, well, part of that and also obviously my other skills was what got me my first job after leaving uni, which was to work at Computer Week, which later became PC Week Australia, with the incomparable Bill Dawes in Sydney. So I worked in Sydney for 5 years on PC Week, and then after that on Internet World Australia and IDM, as it's known now. It used to be called Image and Data Manager, and obviously with Internet World Australia magazine, that was the preeminent magazine for the Australian internet industry at the time. So I got to meet a lot of the people, the movers and shakers in the first dot-com boom in Australia, and report on them and write articles about them. And after doing that for a while, I could see that, you know, there were a lot of opportunities available for people who knew what they were doing, and I was hoping that I knew what I was doing, but I decided to accept a job offer from a company who was doing, you know, good things in the space, which is a company called Ozbone. It was a collective of medium tier ISPs, internet service providers. And they needed a CEO for their peering business, which was that was what Ozbone was. It was a network of it was basically a server or two in each room of the AAPT server, or the facilities in each capital city. I think there was one in Brisbane, and one in Sydney, and one in Adelaide, and one in Perth, and one in Melbourne. And there was a couple in some of the regional areas. I think there was a couple of guys out in the western Sydney. But they needed someone to run that network and publicise it and sit in rooms with Telstra and their $50 million of lawyers and argue for peering, you know, within the industry. So I thought I knew what I was doing because I'd reported on these guys, and I thought that, you know, I was sick of writing about it. How about I try and do it? So it eventually didn't really work because of not to put too fine a point on it, I wasn't really a businessman at that stage, and so my sales expertise was virtually nil. I was a journalist, you know, I've been trained as a journalist at RMIT. I had no sales jobs before that, and I was expected to do, you know, amongst many other things, sales and writing press releases and marketing and industry relations and, you know, management, and it was a very demanding job, and I wasn't really up to it, you know, to put the truth to it. But in any case, after that, I went back to Melbourne with my tail between my legs and when the bust happened. And worked various jobs, which I won't bore you the details with you. Maybe I'll bore you some other time with the long history. But anyway, that's the most of the history of where I've come to now. I suppose I'm into I've started up this business with Ty Tran, my housemate. We started this up about a year ago, and the ostensible reason we started it up was not for Tinfinger, which some of you might only know us for. It was for Fan Footy, which was a fantasy football website for Australian rules football. So there's not many of those out here. There's one, you know, run under the auspices of the AFL, the local organisation that runs Australian rules football in Australia. But there's a market opportunity. There was a market opportunity, or so we've thought, and you know it still exists, for viable businesses to deliver a good service for the latent industry, which is so, you know, huge in the US and the UK. It really hasn't taken off in Australia because no one's really tried it. To the extent that the America and the US and the UK have. So that's still a business that we're interested in, but obviously the Tinfinger is the other one that we're trying to get to fruition. You know, it's we're dragging our feet a bit, but I suppose you got to expect that when what we're biting off here is something worth pretty big to chew. So we've got to expect that it's not going to happen overnight, I guess. Yes. So I didn't think I'd be rambling on this much, but this is the problem with a one-man podcast, that you've got no one to bounce off of, so you tend to ramble on with no one telling you to shut the hell up when you're getting boring. So I guess that's probably just about all I can fit into, you know, about 15-minute podcast, which I think is about the attention span of anyone, probably even over the attention span of anyone for a podcast that isn't one of those top 10 ones like keithandthegirl.com. What else can I say? There's hopefully a sequel to the Long Tail Camp coming up in December, pretty soon. We should be getting a word of that from the from Ben Barron and Michael Leone on that pretty soon, hopefully. So maybe I'll see some of the people listening to this podcast at a yet-to-be-determined Friday in the near future. And I hope to see you there, and maybe we'll have some code to show to you, maybe not, but can't promise anything, but we'll see how it goes. But I'll be looking forward to meeting any of you listening to this podcast at some time in the short, medium, or long-term future. I'm sure there's plenty of water to go under the bridge on this venture. But anyway, I'm rambling, so I'll stop.